Welcome to the Money Insights Podcast, where high income earners come to learn wealth building strategies that will take them from high income to high net worth. With your hosts, financial and wealth building experts, Christian Allen and Rod Zabriskie.
Welcome into another episode of the Money Insights Podcast. I'm Christian Allen. I'm here with my co-host, Rod the Pod Zabriskie. Rod, what's going on, man?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
I couldn't be better, man. The sun is shining and it hasn't been for a few days, so I'm going to take it.
It's fantastic.
You know what else I'm happy about?
I want to hear it.
I'm really happy that we had a client, an emailer, listener of the show email in and ask for a specific episode topic. So shout out to our guy. He knows who he is. There will be no name associated with it.
Yep.
But shout out to you. For this topic for today, we're going to be talking about retirement income planning. It is a topic that we've hit on at various times in the past, right? Now, it's been several months, like maybe even a year or two since we like did a specific podcast about it, but that's why it felt like good timing. So today we're going to talk about some of the various options that we can use for retirement income planning. And specifically, we want to look at like the various types of accounts that exist and like the sequence of when I would take out of one account versus another.
Yeah.
We want to figure out how we bring all of our financial pieces together and come up with an income plan that's efficient, that works and produces the most amount of income, the least amount of taxes, and make sure that I accomplish any other objectives. For example, maybe it's passing money on to heirs or whatever else. So
Sure. Anyway,
I'm excited, Rod, because we're going to be breaking this down today.
Yeah, it's great. Again, and the cool thing is that we have episodes out there about annuities or about cash flowing assets or about, you know, some of these different topics. This kind of brings a lot of those elements together.
It very much does. I think the starting point is to bash the traditional. We're just going to bash the traditional retirement income plan. Let's just get it out of the way, right? Because we've talked. Like philosophically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's the, we call it retirement cash flow planning, right? Because
yep.
In the alternative space, I'm trying to create cash flows. Now, it doesn't mean that there's no place for appreciation and other types of accounts, but if I can create a situation where I have really consistent, comfortable, predictable cash flow, I'm just always in a safe and good position.
Yeah.
Versus, Rod, the accumulation method, which is I try to accumulate a bunch of money and then I'll decide what to do with it at some point. So,
Yes. So
the first thing we would say is I just want to remind people that philosophically, we are very much on the side of be strategic all the way through, create income sources, and then it's a matter of determining where to go with which one in order to maximize their taxes. And can I just say, if you're a high income earner, if you're a good saver, there's a real chance that your income plan looks very similar in your younger years as it will in your older years, because again, if you're a good saver, you're going to have assets. And so it's going to be kind of the same principles that we're going to be using. Just, you know, we're just going to be, let's say I'm drawing income from a piece of real estate now and less from my job as a doctor.
Yep.
Right. Yep. But anyway, those are the things we're going to be talking about, Rod. Why don't you take a minute and just like berate all of the traditional, no, I'm just kidding. Just throw out some of the kind of traditional stuff that we typically see. And then we'll talk about some of the problems or challenges we see with it. And then we'll start getting more into, hopefully into like solutions and do ideas that people can use to go out and make their income plan more effective.
Yeah, absolutely. And you used an important word a minute ago, principles. This is a principle-based approach. Instead of just saying, hey, I'm handing my money to someone, letting them grow it as best they can, and then tell me how much I can take out when I get to retirement. Let's be more strategic. Let's be more intentional about the way that we're building up towards this. Because, okay, so now getting into the...
Okay, wait. I have to agree with you, Rod, but I have to add something before I interject really quick.
Okay.
In relation to this principled concept, it's not just about handing it over to other people. It's also that you're not going to get from us a direct roadmap that says you take out from this account first, then this account next, then this account next. That's not how it works, right?
Yep.
So anyway, I just wanted to make sure we're emphasizing the principle of one, keeping control, right? Making sure that we're in charge of our own financial future. But then secondly, making sure we understand that it's not always going to look the same. There's not a cookie cutter approach that fits everybody and makes it work. It's very much going to depend. Oh, I hate that word. But anyway, keep going.
Yeah, well, that's the key. Because, and here's the deal, the cool thing that we have is we have a vantage point on a whole bunch of people out there who are doing really cool things building towards retirement, or a lot of them even in retirement. And guess what? The mix of assets for those all those people, they look different, right? You can have people who come from the same industry. They were all interested in investing in real estate or things like that. They may even have been business owners. Side by side, you think, oh, well, that seems like there should be like a plan that would be set for those people. But turns out some of their objectives are different, the way they live, where they live. All these differences point you to differences in the way you're going to carry it out. So it depends. And that's what that's, I think, the one of the key points that we want to make is you get to build your own model and do it based on principles, but don't just do it because, you know, so-and-so guru out there said this is how you should do it.
Now, the good news is we'll help educate you, but we'll also work with you to do it. So if you're somebody that needs help in creating an actual income, a strategic income plan, we are more than happy to work with you to do that. While obviously a lot of what we do, and people think of us in the life insurance space, we've spent our entire career working in this financial planning space more broadly. So The income world is one that we are intimately familiar with. So don't hesitate to reach out if you're trying to figure this out and you're saying, here's what I've got going, what do I do? Again, what we're not going to do is tell you, here's what exactly where you should take things. What we will do though, is we'll say, okay, what are the goals, objectives? What are you trying to accomplish? What are the assets and things that are available to accomplish those? Now let's bring them together to create the most effective income plan, which again means highest income, lowest taxes, lowest expenses. But then we don't want to forget some of those tertiary kind of things that we want to, goals that we want to accomplish, whether it's, you know, helping the homeless or what, you know, it could be a million different things. So we just want to make sure that we're incorporating all of those things. A lot of people don't realize, just as a quick example, that charitable things can be obviously a benefit to the people that we're giving to, but it can also be incredibly beneficial for us. And sometimes there's really unique and cool opportunities that can be equally as beneficial for both sides, to where you can give and still get, you know, basically just as much as you give back because of those tax benefits that are associated with it. So I know I've been all over the place, Rod. Get us back on focus and let's make sure we beat up at least briefly on the 4%. I would feel amiss if we didn't at least bring it up.
Yeah.
But I don't want to spend too much time on it.
Okay. So yeah, we'll hit on that right now. So the 4% rule, or kind of this accumulation planning that you talked about earlier, is the idea that you build up, and as long as you build up to whatever number that is that gets you to your goals,
25 times your income. 25 times. 25 if you've got times, that, you are you're good
your goal
for life. Doesn't matter how long you're going to live. Doesn't matter what any all the other factors are irrelevant, right?
Yep. So if you need whatever, $100,000 of income, then you build up your $4 million of assets, turn the income on, and you're good.
Right. We can wrap this up already. We're 9 minutes in. Game, set, match. Obviously, it's not that simple. And certainly it's not that simple, even if you're in that space. What happens though is that we constantly hear that message from the media, right? Like, I know I've said this. I feel like I've said this on 20 pods, but like, it, every time I hear the traditional income planning methods, and again, the 4% rule or some variation of that, I just think to myself, how many times do people have to debunk it before we decide to do something different?
Yeah.
And yet it just keeps being pushed and pushed and pushed in different, like I said, sometimes it's not called the 4% rule. It's just make sure that you save 25 times your income and you're golden, right? Mm-hmm. But it has the same implication. Well, here's the deal. When we talk about from a tax specific standpoint, it's incredibly ineffective to just build up a lump sum of money and take income from it, right? Yeah. Like there's a lot of ways that I can bring in more money, pay less taxes, and ultimately, you know, have more control and enjoy my life more fully. So that's what we're going to try to focus in on. Okay. So 4% rule is a disaster.
Right? Yeah.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
This is a big one. What would ChatGPT tell you to do?
Yeah, it's a great question. ChatGPT is nothing more than the conglomeration of all of the opinions out there. And so guess what the loudest voice is telling ChatGPT?
Okay, but Rob, there's a story behind this.
Yeah.
You forgot to tell the story behind it. So I brought up the basis for this conversation, which came from a friend, client, listener of ours. And he was kind enough to send us what ChatGPT actually said. So I thought you were going to say, well, funny you should ask, Christian. I actually know exactly what ChatGPT says. But it was funny when I saw that. So ChatGPT basically said, a common strategy is to take your non-qualified accounts first, then go to your taxable accounts, then go to your Roth accounts. And I was thinking, what a terrible strategic plan.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the good news is most people, at least I hope, most people aren't going to be listening to ChatGPT. And I know our guy was just sending it to us to be funny.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting because I actually have met with a lot of people over the years who are following basically that methodology.
Right.
Right. So we're saying that's not effective.
Well, it's not effective. And it's basically oversimplifying the whole thing. Even the whole accumulation, the whole idea of 25 times your income, and then you just live off of that. I mean, that's just what you do, right? The idea that you can simplify it to that level. And when you break it down and like if you met with that advisor that was telling you that and you said, okay, well, show it to me, then they would say, okay, well, we're going to assume that you make X amount of return every year, that your income is this, it's going to increase for inflation based on this rate. And again, for planning purposes, we have to make assumptions at some level, but the idea of we're just going to solve for all the variables of the future and then tell you, you know, that it kicks out this answer and it's really simple. You just live off of this and take them out in this sequence. Life is much more complex than that. You can't break it down to just a simple formula at the end of the day.
Yeah. Because think about it, right? You might like, let's just say theoretically you've got, I could get into 100 things, but if I have, depending on where my income is being derived from, whether it's 1099 income or W-2 income, whether it's passive income, that could have an impact on whether I decide to take income from somewhere else. Because what most people don't realize is that where I take money from impacts not just where I take it from, but from a tax standpoint, it impacts all of those things. And it certainly could do the same from like a management perspective, like an asset allocation management, meaning like, you know, if this asset is coming from Social Security in retirement and this one's coming from an annuity, do I want another fixed asset? Do I want it to be, variable? Do I want it to be real estate? Like, regardless of what that mixture ends up being, each one of those has at least some impact on the other. And so when we're thinking about it, again, it's not as simple as checking the boxes. It's as simple as just looking at the whole and making some strategic decisions, Rod. That's easy.
Yep.
Okay, but we're going to get into what some of those ideas are, right?
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about first, just talk through a list of the assets that we're kind of just isolating and saying these types of accounts, these types of assets make up our options for creating the income in retirement. Okay. So it's stuff traditional retirement accounts. Those are called defined contribution. That includes 401k, IRA, SEPs and 403bs and all kinds of different things. But defined contribution just meaning that the IRS is telling you how much you can put in, no more, Like there are limits on how much you can contribute. So that's why we call it defined contribution. The second category that's similar, but they call it defined benefit. This would be things like pensions. And the idea on this one is the IRS is stating, well, in the future, you're going to be taking income out of this. We're defining how much you can take. Therefore, that determines how much you can put in today. So that's, again, those two are the most common that people think about. Well, let's keep going because a lot of people are building up non-qualified, like non-retirement account assets in the stock market, right? So that would be included. So security, you mentioned that would be included. And now we're getting into more of the alternative space, real estate, business, annuities, life insurance, and all kinds of other alternative assets that could be included, whether they be, you know, purely cash flowing or, you know, some mix of different things. But that's basically the list that we're working from as we're going to now kind of build out the principles.
And so basically what we have to do is we have to understand where the options are. And then, of course, what we have, and probably most importantly, is what is the tax implication of that account, right?
Yep.
So obviously in the qualified space, we know that they're all tax deferred. I'm getting a tax deduction today, which could be really advantageous, but it might not,
yep.
Right? So one of those factors that I'm going to be considering is you know, when I need tax benefits. Okay, so that's a good list. That at least gives us kind of an idea. And like you said, there's a myriad of different assets or things that you could be using that would probably fit in something similar to what we've listed out here. Okay, Rod. So I want to hit on this idea of asset allocation. I brought it up for a second.
Yeah.
But the reason I do is because I have strong opinions around asset allocation. Okay.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to go back to the traditional world for just a minute because. Okay. Typically what happens when we think about asset allocation and retirement income planning, the common answer is that as I get older, I reduce the risk in my portfolio, right? I remember what I was told, and it's just shocking that this kind of stuff's still out there, but it should be about, the allocation should match your age. I'm not even kidding. This is like a thing,
yeah.
Like an actual thing. And so, you know, if I'm 20 years old, I'm investing in the market, I should be 80% into stocks and 20% into bonds. Similarly, if I'm 70 years old, I should be in 70% bonds and 30% stocks, right? This is just a ridiculous idea. Like it really is absolutely ridiculous. I've read, I remember this was years ago, but I read a bunch of studies and it was because I was more in that traditional space,
yep.
Right? And I was trying to kind of grasp and understand why someone would do different things, specifically in this retirement income space. And what I found was that there is absolutely no indication that that's a more effective model. Right. In fact, for most people, they just get lower returns and therefore run out of money even more quickly.
Yeah.
Now, so the question is, okay, Christian, are you just saying you go be crazy risky as you get into retirement? No, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that there's places that can invest that might not be in stocks or bonds that can create a third level of asset diversification and give me the income stream that I want without having to sacrifice some of the benefits that I'm potentially looking for.
Yeah.
So anyway, my main message there is if you've heard the idea of you just go automatically, no matter who you are, the rule is as you get older, you reduce risk. And I would say, honestly, especially if you're a high income earner, I can't come up with any logical reason why someone would be like, okay, I'm just going to like really rein it in completely as I continue to grow, mm-hmm. because there's an element of what got me here, right?
Yep.
Now, I do want to say this, right? Like if there's assets and there's things that I'm specifically, that I've determined need to go to a specific situation and cause, it's totally reasonable to say, I'm going to set this aside and make sure that there's no risk associated with that asset. Or another example is it's a really great idea to have a portion of your assets that are that carry little to no risk, right? So yep. We love life insurance as an asset. That's a great example. I can use life insurance for my investing, but I can hold a bunch of life insurance in a policy that I know is safe, predictable there for me. And so part of it, again, is like matching up the assets together to, again, create the benefit that we want. But again, my message is you shouldn't definitively say, all right, as I get older, as I get into this retirement income phase, I just have to like reduce and minimize my risk, because there's a lot of reasons and a lot of data to suggest that that's actually far less effective. Well, if you own a bunch of cash flowing assets, then this probably isn't as big of a deal anyway. Mm-hmm. But those are my thoughts on asset allocation in retirement.
Well, and the irony of that is that, remember the Monte Carlo simulations that they run? They're not assuming that you adjust that. They're saying a 60-40 portfolio, right?
Yes, they are.
So it totally conflicts with that idea of moving less, moving more toward bonds, more toward fixed assets as the older you get. That's not what they're saying in that model. When even the whatever created that 4% rule wasn't in jive with that, with what you're describing there either.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it might be, and it likely would be, because what they did is they tried to create the optimal scenario. So yeah. Like if we would have come back and said, hey, we now adjust it to a 30-70 portfolio, like we don't have the results of that, but you know, chances are it might be a little bit scary.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, that's good. So let's get into the tax elements, because This is kind of maybe not the biggest focus, but certainly one of. We always emphasize taxes as a high income earner. Taxes are our best friend and worst enemy. No, they're our closest friend, but worst enemy. We have a lot of taxes we have to pay, unless we don't. So the question is, how do I make sure that I'm being tax efficient as I get into this retirement income phase?
Yeah, absolutely. And this becomes an opportunity to, by planning ahead, by thinking ahead, we're not putting all of our eggs in one basket as it relates to taxes either, right? So we have examples of clients we worked with, and they worked hard. They had traditional assets, they had pension, they had Social Security, and then they had to face the fact that for the rest of their life, any of their own money that they pulled back out of those accounts was going to be fully taxable at income tax rates. But when you mix in a lot of these other things, so you have a combination, right? So you may have some pre-tax dollars, and I think we're pretty consistent. We don't tell people that it's always a horrible idea to have pre-tax 401k or whatever, right? For a few reasons. Number one, if you can get the match, then great. Number two,
yeah, well, because even if the tax elements are there, if you're getting 100% match, as an example, if I get a 1-to-1, even if I have to pay 40% taxes, well, I still end up coming out far ahead. So that's just like good logic. And can I also just tell you that, like, run away from the people who are telling you like these are like the hard and fast rules. I hear people in like closer to our space. What I mean is people who like life insurance, that's probably the better way to say it, who would suggest like, no, there's no place for qualified plans or those types, because that money should just go into life insurance. Like the reality is that that's a bad idea, especially if you're getting a match. So I just wanted to emphasize, I think that's a good point you made.
Yeah. So the mix is going to be pre-tax. Let's call it normal tax or partially taxable, because if you're in a place where you're getting capital gains and it's not in a special retirement account or anything like that, well, you're going to pay tax as you go, right? So there's those. Yeah. And then there are tax-free, which would be things like a Roth or things like life insurance, where the money you've put in has already been taxed. But then later on, as you're then pulling money back out of the account, you get to take it out income tax free. So
okay.
Diversification and asset allocation as it relates to tax is a huge deal as well. So we talk about, we always want to be our most tax efficient, you know, most tax efficient way to approach things. The problem is that it often gets us into trouble. And I'll give you an example. You go to your CPA, they put your return together, they come back and say, this is what you're going to owe in taxes. You say, I don't want to pay that much in taxes. Well, typically what do they come back with? Oh, well, you can set up a SEP, or you can set up, you know, whatever. We'll defer that tax. You don't have to pay that. What they don't say is you're going to, but you're not paying it today, right? So is that the most tax efficient approach? No. The answer is no. If you're always deferring the tax, eventually you're going to have to pay it. You get into the situation like I gave you a minute ago where in retirement, now everything is taxed.
And that's obviously incredibly inefficient because as we get into retirement, oftentimes we don't have the same kind of expenses that we have earlier in our life that could be deductible, right? So then we're like compounding the problem. We're basically putting it off and then compounding and making it worse. So like you said, you want to start with the end in mind and be thinking about when you're investing on the front end, you do want to be thinking at least in theory and philosophy and principle, maybe that's the best word, about how I want to start bringing the money back out. Because, well, let's just say it this way. If you get all in on one asset, it could end up being a ticking time bomb and, you know, create all sorts of mess that you don't want to have to deal with.
Yeah. And so going back to the ChatGPT answer that we got, sequencing and saying, well, initially I'm always going to take out of these accounts and then I'll shift to the taxable accounts and then I'll shift to the tax-free. Well, why not take a balance of income out of the mix today? Because
so here's the question. I was going to say, well, what are the factors, Rod, that make us determine whether, you know, where we would potentially take from?
Yeah, because someone might come back and say, okay, Rod, well, I've put everything into a place where it's taxed. I've already paid the tax and it's going to come out income tax free for me for the rest of my life. How can that be bad? I'm going to say it's not bad, but it's not quite fully efficient either. Because think about this. When you file your return each year, you can choose the standardized deduction, right? The standard deduction, which I think for a couple is around 30 grand, just under 30 grand today. Well, what if you have money in a fully taxable account, a 401k that was not Roth-ized, and you can take up to 30,000 a year of income from that? Well, you're not going to get taxed on that because that just fits under the standard deduction, right? So is there a more efficient model than everything comes out tax-free? Yeah, there actually is.
Yeah, and the chances are that it is some balancing act between what's happening. And
that's it.
And the difficult thing here is that, again, there's not a formulaic one-size-fits-all. So it ends up being looking at each situation and saying, okay, where are you taking money from today? How can we complement that with the most tax efficient overall strategy? So what it means then is looking at the whole, potentially reducing from some places and increasing from some, and considering the impact of what it means today, as well as the impact of what it means in the future.
Yeah.
And so that's like the principled approach that we have to be thinking about and using.
Yeah. And part of that is while I'm in accumulation phase, I am making different decisions that impact the tax that I may or may not have in retirement. So I'll give you an example. A lot of people that we see are counting on continuing to acquire new properties to get more bonus depreciation, to have losses to offset the income that they're getting from the real estate that they bought last year and 5 years ago and 10 years ago, right? Well, in retirement, are you going to continue to acquire assets? And a lot of our clients would say, well, yes, I'm never planning to get out of the game. Well, but what happens when you're, whatever, 80, 90 years old and you don't have the just cognitive wherewithal to continue to keep up with that? Well, then what? So part of it is just thinking through some of these differences between what we're used to and what we're doing right now compared to what we will be doing or will be able to do in the future.
Okay, let's switch topics for a second. Spend just a minute on Social Security. This is one that earlier in my career, I spent a lot of time focusing on and learning because so many people in that baby boomer generation are at least partially reliant on Social Security. Now, I realize that many of the people listening to this are probably not too worried about Social Security and its impact. But regardless, it's important to understand the impact of it because, again, a lot of times people don't realize that because I have that income, it could impact my tax implications somewhere else. So maybe just hit on Social Security, and then we'll talk about how to incorporate alternative assets or what that looks like. And then, Rod, we'll have some fun and we'll learn more about your style and maybe even mine. We'll see like what we're planning to do from a retirement income perspective.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. So with Social Security, man, this is again another one of those where people want me to say everyone should do this, start taking it at such and such age and whatever. But there's not a clean answer for that. But here's what the little bit of analysis that we've done, again, back in the day, leads us to kind of these principles. So number one is when you should start taking it depends on your taxable income in those years. So in other words, if you're 62 and you could start taking income from it, but you're still working, you still have a certain level of income coming in, that falls into that active income category, well then you don't want to take it yet, because to the extent that you're receiving normal income, that offsets the benefit that you get. So you started at the lower income amount, but you're not actually getting all of that until later, right? So some of this may be like obvious, right? You might look at it and say, well, that just makes sense. On the other hand, if you're 62, you've already retired, you don't have any active income coming in. And then the question is, well, do I take it now so I can get the clock ticking? Or do I wait? If I wait till I'm 67 or 70 and the income goes up 8% every year between now and then, that just seems to make sense that I should wait. Well, the answer to that one depends on where you would get your income from in the meantime, right? If you have enough passive income from different investments, then great, like go ahead and start. On the other hand, if those assets fall more on the traditional side and they're sitting in some asset allocated fund, and you're saying, well, I'm going to take those assets while I'm waiting to take the income. Well, it may not be most optimal to do that. You may actually be better off taking the income today and eating those assets less as a result. So, but again, these are the kinds of things that you want to be thinking about as it relates to when you start taking it.
Rod, either Reagan or Roosevelt. I know that's like not, but one of the two.
Okay.
One of the two said that Social Security would never be taxable.
Oh, yeah. That was probably Roosevelt because he's the one that set it up.
Makes more sense. I was feeling like Reagan's probably not far enough back. Yeah. So Roosevelt sets it up, says it'll never be taxed. But guess what? He wasn't able to stand by that one, because now up to 85% of our Social Security can be taxed at our regular income tax rate. So Social Security is an asset that we can utilize and can be a benefit. But to your point before, like if I'm already taking income from somewhere else, I could actually lower the efficiency of what I'm getting there by turning on my Social Security and creating more taxability on the other. Now, so again, it's just creating a balancing act and making sure we understand what works. Like I really do get that for the majority of people listening to our show, they're less concerned about this, but if it's there, I say they're less concerned. And yet if you're someone that's getting $3,000 or $4,000, $5,000 a month for the next, 20, 30 years, it ends up being a pretty big asset. Right. So regardless of whether you're looking at Social Security as a key part of your retirement income cog, just make sure that you know the impact that it's having and be thoughtful about when you're actually going to take the income. Because again, there's just some basic principles. I obviously every year I wait, I get an increase. And so I look at that and I might say, okay, I don't need it today. So I like the idea that I can maximize my increases. And then it's really a question of how long we're going to live, which is why this is impossible to answer.
Yes.
Right? If I live a long life, then I probably wanted to wait, get that bump in income, and then live it out. And I, We could, you know, in every situation, you could go and find out like what the individual's break even point. Okay. Yeah. If you live till 77 and a half, you will be better off by doing this than doing this. But obviously we don't know that factor. Yep. So there's a lot of things we do know. We don't know our death date for the most part. So let's focus on the things that we do know. But again, let's not like stick our head in the sand and just say like, okay, regardless of what's happening here, I just decided I'm going to do this with no thought behind it.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I'm glad you brought up the taxation part of it, because that is a shocker for everybody the first time they hear that. They're like, wait a minute, it was taken from me as a tax to go into Social Security. And then they're going to give it back and say, yes, it's taxable.
Yes, it's taxable. They very much are.
It is messed up.
Oh, but don't worry. 15% of it is free and clear. Now, let me be clear. It's not taxed at an 85% rate. 85% of the total amount will be taxable. And again, for people listening to this show, like pretty much everybody is going to fit into that category where all of it, well, sorry, 85%, the maximum amount is going to be taxable at their going income tax rate.
Yeah.
Okay. That's enough about Social Security, Rod. Let's talk about incorporating alternative assets and like maybe just give some thoughts and ideas around why, you know, where we see alternative assets fitting specifically as it relates to the income side, right? So oftentimes we talk about building our wealth through real estate investing, but where does that kind of stuff fit when I want to kind of wind down a little bit more?
Yeah, it's a great question, because depending on how I invest in real estate determines, well, cash flow as an example, right? So for example, if I'm investing in real estate syndications as an example, that may or may not have a lot of cash flow, or as some people are finding out, the cash flow may be less predictable than I wish it was. Then I have to approach it in a completely different mindset than it would be if it really was like I own a piece of property, it has income that's pretty consistent, and I'm counting on it in terms of what's reasonable and all the different, you know, factors that I have to consider on the income. I want to have it from multiple streams, right? Multiple different places where it's coming from that are diversified as it relates to the risk. But my point is, like for me right now, because I'm still in accumulation phase, no big deal if I put money into something and I'm not going to see that for a few years, right? Because even the cash flow that comes now, I'm just setting aside to go out and invest in something else again anyway, right? I'm not living off of it. So that's different. That's going to be different as I'm building up and getting closer to that retirement age. Then I need to shift the type of assets I'm investing in to be more cash flow based. Hopefully there's still appreciation, but that's not as much my focus. It's more on creating those streams of income that will take care of me when I'm
one of the nice things about kind of focusing on this cash flow retirement income method, again, delineating between what we typically see, like the traditional methodology, build up a pile of money, then figure out what to do with it. The first part, or the first way that I think alternative assets comes into play, is that alternative assets in general, alternative investments, let's put it this way. There are more opportunities inside the alternative investment space to create cash flow, right? So if I want to move away from this accumulation model and get onto the cash flow model, then the first way that alternative investments become really vital is that that's at least one place I can go. The other thing that's happening at the same time is that I'm creating a natural diversification, not only of the actual income I'm bringing out, but also of the taxes, right? We talk about, so if I purchase a property and I get depreciation and I use cost segregation and then it produces an income for me, like I have accomplished a lot of things in that. I've diversified from my typical, you know, stocks, bonds, mutual fund portfolio or my 401k or defined benefit plan. And now I'm enhancing or optimizing what's happening with those by reducing the possible tax implications of it, right? So again, that's, and the reason I'm doing that is because as I continue to invest, I am able to get some of those tax benefits. Now, to your point earlier, that may not always be the case. There may come a time where I'm not putting in the same kind of new money. So I want to be thinking about in each investment, what's the implication today? What's the implication in the both mid and long term? And specifically, what's the implication upon how this asset, or what does this asset look like when it passes on to the next generation? Yeah. But anyway, there's a lot of places that you can utilize alternative investments inside retirement income planning. And I think, I mean, for our crowd here, like, it's probably going to be like a 50-50 type thing, maybe even less, maybe more on the alternative side and less on the accumulation side. But the point here is most people have both. And so the key then is to, again, I feel like I'm regurgitating the same thing, but I've got to list everything out. I've got to understand the implication of each thing from a return perspective, from a risk perspective, from a tax perspective. And then I have to make decisions at, that ultimately get me to where I want to go. So it's not a, again, it's not one size fits all. Rod, my man Rod, is happy to get into the weeds with you, though. I promise he'll go through it with you.
Yeah, and I'll add one more element to what you just discussed, and that is liquidity. Because the same reasons we needed liquidity when we were in the accumulation phase, we need liquidity when we're in that income phase. Things can happen, right? From a bunch of different angles, both in terms of where my cash flow is coming from the standpoint of unexpected expenses, from the standpoint of my health, right? All kinds of different things, the what ifs of the future. And so we can't get so hyper-focused on the income part of it that we forget about some of these other pieces as well.
Yeah, that is a great point. And the alternative space tends to have more illiquid investments associated with it, right? Yep. Because you're so often invested. Well, a couple of reasons. One, it's not as commercialized, right? Mm-hmm. And number two, you're oftentimes investing in hard assets rather than paper assets.
Yep.
Okay, Rod, let's bring this thing all together. So what we're going to do next is we're going to talk about a few kind of philosophies that we find useful, that we think will be beneficial for people to hear about. Mm-hmm. So Rod, I'm going to let you take it away. We're going to talk about Tom Hegna's kind of his philosophy around income planning, Wade Fowles, and most importantly, Rod the Pod Zabriskie's income plan. You can write it down, take it to the bank.
Okay.
Let's
start with Tom Hegna. So okay.
Tom Hegna, by the way.
Yeah, he's been around a while. He's written a couple of books. Paychecks and Playchecks is one of them.
Yeah.
But really, that's the philosophy that we're going to focus on. And his idea on that one is, if you can identify your basic income needs, how much do you need just to make it month to month to month, right? Mm-hmm. Covering your most basic needs, then create guaranteed income around that. And then for all of the playchecks, the lifestyle, the trips, the whatever you want to be doing with your life, then you're planning that separately. So in other words, the guaranteed income part of it, the different assets we talked about would be things like the pension, an annuity, Social Security, if you want to think of it that way, right? A lot of people would cringe at me saying guaranteed income. Yes.
And a guaranteed income. Yeah, that's interesting. So what you're saying, though, is, just to be really clear, I'm basically separating these two, this into two elements. I'm separating into my needs.
Yep.
And I'm just coming up with something that is rock solid, that covers my needs.
Yep.
Again, philosophically, even if everything goes to hell in a handbasket, I know that I've got my needs met.
Yep.
And so then Tom's saying, once you do that, you can go invest how you want. Is that basically the philosophy? Yes.
Yeah. So then you might say, okay, well, which assets am I using for each of those? And again, there could be a mix. You mentioned life insurance is really good on the guaranteed side. When we talk about annuities, an annuity can be qualified money. It could have been a rollover from your 401k or IRA. And so it, now as it's coming out of the annuity, you're receiving that income, it's just fully taxable. It can be non-qualified money, what you had in the brokerage account, or maybe you sell a property or a portion of your business or something, and now you have cash and you drop that into the annuity. And then as it comes out, it's partially taxable based on the growth that you have happening inside of it. So those are good assets to use for kind of that guaranteed side. And then on the other side, then it is those cash flowing assets. And again, to the extent that you want to be invested in traditional assets, but that kind of allocation model you talked about earlier, well, now you can afford to be a little more aggressive with it because your basic needs are taken care of. You go with a 80-20 investment model or whatever, because you can, right?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm thinking about this throughout the paycheck. Okay. So if I've covered my needs, mm-hmm. what kinds of things do we suppose make sense for people to invest in at that point? Now, I also want to just bring up another quick point. In terms of what is the most solid, the most secure asset at covering this need, that's where annuities come in. People mm-hmm. oftentimes ask us, like, is there a place for annuities? Well, if you're buying into Tom's philosophy, like, there's probably no better asset that I can own. Again, maybe if it's like a state pension or something like that. But mm-hmm. like, aside from something like that, this is like as strong of an asset as we can own. Now, I only mention that because even if we decide, hey, I'm going to go, you know, create cash flow through real estate, there is at least I want to acknowledge that there is an element of additional risk that I'm taking on the real estate side, right? So it's not exactly even, although I do think they fit in the same camp, right? They fit in that, okay, they're creating a guaranteed income stream. But again, I just want to emphasize that like annuity would be like your very most core, you know, you can take that thing to the bank, never have to worry about it.
Yep.
Okay. So we've got that part covered. Now we're getting into our paychecks. Let's enjoy some paycheck. We're getting into the playchecks.
Yeah. Yeah. And then on this one, now this incorporates all of those other things where you, again, you're invested in real estate or whatever you like to invest in. That's where you're putting the funds to grow. And then you're using them. And again, we still use the same principles we talked about earlier in terms of tax balance and risk balance and liquidity and all these different things still come into play. But because our basic needs are covered, that just gives us a little more license, freedom to maybe be a little more aggressive on that side than we would be willing to be if those assets were covering all of our income needs.
Okay, I love it. Tom, thank you. It's a simple philosophy, but at least it's a philosophy that you can live with, right? Yeah. You can run with, feel safe with. And again, it is a whole lot better than like the 4% rule philosophy, which, by the way, the biggest problem with it isn't that it's inefficient. The biggest problem is that it could leave you desolate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, even if there's a 1 out of 5 chance or a 1 out of 10 chance, like, I don't want to get into that. Okay, sorry. Okay, that's Tom's, Rod. Let's talk about our man Wade Fow's answer and talk about, before you do that, who's Wade Fow?
Yeah, so Wade Fow is basically a professor at a university who was asked to analyze kind of this bridge between the traditional world and specifically in the way that his report comes out, annuities and life insurance. Okay.
Now, isn't he at the American College? Is that right?
He is.
Okay. So I want to just clarify, it's not just any college. American College is literally a college for financial planning. And so Wade Fow had built a philosophy. And from my understanding, they sought him out after he created the philosophy and framework for this. And it's really interesting. A ton of people have adopted it. And can I just tell you, it is so much more foundational, like solid from a foundational standpoint than what we see in that, again, comparing with the 4% rule, which is the most common. But anyway, yes. So Wade Fow is really cool. He has some really good ideas. What is his ideas?
The question. Yeah. So basically what he's saying is there's this like competition out there. Should you go traditional or should you go alternatives / annuities / life insurance? And what his answer is, no, do both. So for example, using the 4% rule as an example, if you say, no, I'm going to keep all of my assets in the market at this 60-40 allocation, follow the 4% rule, you're just at more risk you doing that. So then you say, well, if the alternative is that, I'm not interested in just doing annuities and life insurance, right? Okay, but what if you did some combination of both? So for example, he has what he calls the covered asset strategy. And that one's a lot like Tom Hegna's. It's just less paychecks oriented. It's more like, hey, create guaranteed levels of income, still keep money that's in the stock market, but because you have the guaranteed income, then you have a little more freedom on the other side. So again, it's very similar.
But there is an element here that we're not touching on. When he's talking about this covered asset, what he's actually saying is that I'm going to spend down an asset and then I'm going to replace it.
Yes.
So the asset that's being covered when they talk about it, and that is, hey, so here's what it would look like. I have $10 million. Now, again, I'm oversimplifying, but I'm going to take a few million dollars, right? And I'm going to use this to create an income. But what I'm going to do, I don't want to just like eliminate it altogether and never get it. Like, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to purchase life insurance with a portion of the income from that asset. I'm going to take the income, but then I'm going to replace the asset using life insurance for my heirs, whether that's my spouse or my kids. And so the idea then is to actually be able to use the money without depleting the money. And so from that standpoint, it is a little bit different than what Tom's saying, but definitely in the same ballpark.
Yeah, because there are certain types of annuities you get into and you get higher income, but the asset no longer exists. You literally traded your asset for that guaranteed stream of income. Oh, but then the question is always, but what if I die next year or whatever in the short term, and all of a sudden that asset's gone? And he's saying, well, you've taken care of that because you have this life insurance that kicks in and covers your spouse, again, depending on planning, and or making sure your kids still get that inheritance, that somebody gets the benefit of that, but you still got the higher amount of income because you chose the annuity option that you lose the asset. So the other one is the volatility buffer strategy. And this becomes a situation where you're incorporating all three of the different asset types, traditional assets, life insurance, and annuity. Actually, not even necessarily annuity. It could be annuity or life insurance, some combination of the two. But in this case, what he's saying is, okay, if you like the 4% rule, and that's what you just want to kind of hit your horse to, then there are inherent risks with it, but we can de-risk that. In other words, if you have an asset that is not correlated to the stock market, that you can rely on when the stock market is down, then that's going to be much more efficient. In other words, because here's what happens. If you're using the 4% rule, the market's down, you don't care. You just keep taking your income, right? So say it's the $10 million asset person, and the 2008 comes, your asset drops by 40%. Now it's $6 million in there, but you still took your, whatever it was, $400,000 of income. Well, now all of a sudden it's not down 40%, it's down 44%. You've kind of killed some of the worker bees, so to speak, even beyond what the market had done. And so recovering from that is really tough, even though the market responded and recovered and did great, because you were taking more money out during those down years, you just compounded the issue. It takes a lot more growth to overcome those losses. And so that's the problem. That's one of the inherent issues with the 4% rule. But what if you experienced the 40% loss in your portfolio and then you didn't take the income out of there? You had another asset that is not correlated to the stock market. That's what you're able to take your income from in those down years, allowing your original asset to recover and surpass, getting back above the $10 million mark like the market did. But having somewhere else you were taking the income in the interim. And if you do that, then not only does the 4% rule work, you could actually potentially take a higher percentage out of that 5-6% and still be more safe, more secure, because you can have this alternative source of income when the market's down.
Yeah. And it really is just it's the way I think of it is it's just a way to hedge your risk,
yep.
right? And put yourself in a better long-term position. And so we always tell people, right? Like you commonly hear the phrase, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. And that is certainly true, but it would actually be broken down a little further than that, right? Don't put all your eggs in the same types of basket makes just as much sense. And so here yeah. we're suggesting, okay, if I've got my money in the market, or even if I've got all my money in real estate, right? I want to have some things that are uncorrelated regardless of where I'm at. Now, yeah. he's specifically talking about the market in this analysis, but I would be more broad with that because regardless of what asset it is, we want to be thoughtful and smart and we don't want to have all of it. And therefore, it makes sense to have an uncorrelated asset so that, to your point, if and when something goes wrong with that asset, we can give it the time to recover. We're not feeling the stress and anxiety that comes with, oh, I need this today. Therefore, you know, I'm in pain. Instead, yep. I can say like, okay, the investment that I chose, it was a solid investment. I chose it for a reason, right? It had good bones. Let's allow it to run its course. And, you know, that gives you some opportunity. Of course, some of it depends on how much of a buffer you have, right? And so for every person, that could look a little bit different,
yep.
but having at least, you know, at least a couple of years worth of another asset that's non-correlated to our primary asset that's creating our income makes, again, creates an additional level of safety. It can also be effective from tax perspective too.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. Because we can accomplish all of those same things. It's still a mixture of different assets. We're just picking those assets, blending those assets, balancing the way I take the income in the same way we described earlier. It's just how we categorize them, whether they fit on this side of the non-correlated or on the side of the market-based / cash flow-based or whatever.
Okay, Rod. The moment we've all been waiting for. We've been building to this moment. We're almost an hour into the pod. It's the perfect time to bust it out. Can you tell us Rod's philosophy around retirement income planning? And is it same, different, or?
Well, yeah, well, the answer is it's principle-based.
Oh, goody.
Based on me. Like, so it's the individual now, because again, every individual is going to be different. So for me, here's where I'm focused. So obviously, I'm a partial owner in the business. So there are mm-hmm. those assets, and it happens to be a business that creates streams of income, residual streams of income. So that obviously makes a big difference.
Yep.
Within that, within some of the contracts that we have, we're building up these tax deferred kinds of plans, right? And so we have a mix. I have a mix built in there that do fit in that kind of the more traditional side, and for reasons I mentioned earlier, will be valuable when it comes time to kind of doing the allocation and where do I take the money from, et cetera, from a tax standpoint, right? I can be strategic in the way that I do that. And then, of course, there are the other cash flowing assets, because I very much do adhere to the philosophy of creating enough passive income to replace my active income. And so when that day comes and I'm doing it, and I kind of hinted at this earlier, I take a different approach now when I'm accumulating, I'm investing in more things that don't necessarily create cash flow. Whereas later on, I'll shift and do more with assets that are cash flow based to include things like the Capital Avalanche, which obviously is very much cash flow based, but in the future, after a kind of a maturing period, then turning that on and creating tax-free income.
And it's a very different cash flow. I'm glad we brought that up. We hadn't talked about it yet, but it's a very different cash flow than, say, a piece of real estate, yep. right? Because the Capital Avalanche, the way that we build it, we're putting in after-tax dollars, creating the leverage, and what's coming out is completely income tax-free. Yep. And so again, like you're creating anyway, I just thought that was a good one as an example to show how you can have different assets that are cash flowing, but the tax implication makes a huge difference too.
Yeah. And one of the ways that shows itself is if I create a like regular income plan and I have predictable tax consequences to how that's working, but then I need to buy a new car, or I'm going to go on a special trip or something. And because I can take that money from a tax-free place, which could be the Capital Avalanche, could be my whole life policies that I was using for my investment optimizer investing, then that doesn't mess up my whole tax plan.
Yeah. Okay. So Rod, you asked me at the beginning, you threw this on me. Yep. So this is a surprise. What is Christian's plan? And I've been thinking about it a little bit as we've been going. And I think my plan is to, my plan is and has always been to start with the end in mind. Now, what do I mean by that? Because that's awfully vague and generic. Mm-hmm. But the way that I invest money today, I like to be diverse in the approach, right? Like I like that I have income that comes from the business, but that I'm investing in a variety of different things that have different tax implications. And so my goal, I think, is to make sure that I'm giving myself the optionality to have creativity on the back end, right? Yeah. I can employ all of the kind of tax principles we've talked about, but I can also look into things like charitable giving strategies that can create huge benefits for charities that our family cares about, but also can be hugely advantageous for us. And so I think for me, like, while I haven't defined specifically what the back end looks like, I mean, none of us have, right? That's sure. Part of the point is we can't define it. Yep. But I do think that the focus is and should always be invest in the things that you can turn into a viable income plan, or that you've got steps in place to make sure that you're ultimately able to do that. And then the last part is make sure that those assets that we're investing in today are also assets that are going to go on to the next generation, because at the end of the day, my goal is to create generational wealth for generations. How about mm-hmm. that? Right. Yep. So anyway, I know that's a little bit vague, but I really think when, I'm 40 years old. So if I'm being totally honest, I don't think a lot about retirement, and I don't think about it in the typical fashion either. Yep. Right. So if I'm being very realistic, my today looks very similar to what my retirement will look like. Mm-hmm. Right. And in terms of income and other things, like there will be more assets and that will continue to build, but I'm still going to be producing income from the business. And so I think it really is important for people to make sure that they start with the end in mind. They're investing in the things that give them the options to be efficient, both from a tax standpoint, from a safety perspective.
Yeah. So that just brings us back to where we started. It is different for every person, right? Even the two of us who, we work together all, every day, our plans vary and will, they'll evolve in different directions. And that's okay. That's the way it should be. And so the same for everybody out there who's listening to this, your plan is going to look different than the person to the right of you, the person to the left of you. But hopefully these principles, these ideas help you as you're formulating how you're going to work towards that and have the best retirement possible.
And again, if you need specific help, reach out to my man, Rod the Pod, rod@moneyinsightsgroup.com. We are more than happy to have the conversations and help create that plan. And even if you're not there yet and you're just wanting to start thinking about how to get there, we're more than happy to spend an hour or half hour on the phone and kind of plan and start to look at how can we be as efficient as possible with that. Okay. Thanks everybody for hanging out with us. Rod, thanks for your concluding thoughts, and see you next week, man.
Thank you for listening to the Money Insights Podcast. To learn more about the financial and business strategies discussed in this show, please visit moneyinsights.net. The views and opinions expressed on the Money Insights Podcast are not intended to be individual financial, tax, or legal advice. Always consult with the appropriate advisor before making financial decisions. And if you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This will help others find the show and learn wealth-building strategies for themselves. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.